So good afternoon, everyone. My name is James Keeler. I'm the head of department and very pleased to welcome you to this session that Dr. Bampos has organized. I think there's a very good chance that we will actually be able to see one another face to face again next term. And I, for one, looking forward to that very much indeed. But in the interim, so to speak, Nick has organized this session, which I hope you'll find very interesting. It's part of the program that he's been putting together to enable people in the department to connect with one another, particularly to connect to some of the more senior researchers, to get a sense of what they're doing, and to get a sense of where they have come from and what has brought them to where they are today. And this is particularly relevant because it is very, very important to us that we maintain the department as an open and a welcoming and an inclusive place, which we're always working towards. So I'm delighted to welcome today our colleague, Claire Gray, Professor Claire Gray. Now, if you want a shorthand for Claire, people say, oh yeah, Claire works on batteries. But that really doesn't do her justice. Claire works on the fundamental science behind batteries, behind other storage devices. And this fundamental science is very complicated indeed. It's a combination of a profound understanding of solid state chemistry and also of the physical methods and theoretical methods you need to understand this. Because these processes that go on in electrical storage devices are exceptionally complex. Claire is a world-leading expert in this area. She leads a very large research group here in the department, and she also coordinates many national and international projects working in this area. So Claire, thank you very much for talking to us, and I will hand over to you. After Claire has spoken, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions via the chat, and Nick will host that. Claire, thank you very much.
Great, thank you. So I'm sitting here in my, in my kitchen with the view of Hobson's Brook behind me during the actually very nice autumn that we had. So one of the nice things for me in lockdown, and insofar as there have been nice things, is I've been locked in Cambridge, and you know, I spent quite a bit of my life traveling, so I've seen more of Cambridge in the seasons than I have ever before. So anyway, I'm afraid I have to start by admitting that I haven't done my undergraduate degree in Cambridge. I did it in Oxford, and so it is possible still to survive if one has not had the training from Cambridge and get somewhere in life. And I have a rather sort of eccentric or diverse background at the start. I was born in Middlesbrough, and then I spent my, I was there for 2 years, and then I spent the next 5 years in Holland, in Den Haag, where I actually learned to speak Dutch. And then I moved to Brussels, where I spoke some French, and then I moved back to English, to England rather, in St. Albans when I was 15, and I promptly forgot a lot of my Dutch and my French, but managed to do some chemistry. And so then I went on to Oxford, where I was at Christ Church, which for those of you at Trinity know is the sister college. It's a very large college, but quite a difficult time then, because that was at the beginning when, I know this might be difficult to imagine, but it was when most of the colleges were just starting to admit women. So there were very few colleges previously that took just the women's colleges. And so Christ Church was in its fourth year of admitting women and hadn't really gone through the exercise about what that meant. So I'm happy to talk about that more for those of you who are interested, but the joyous things we had were little signs on the bathrooms that were shared, which would say things like gentlemen should clean their baths after use. And those of us who were, you know, didn't feel that was very useful for us, didn't feel it was that most appropriate. Anyway, that was the time, and I moved on. And I worked with, so in Oxford, the fourth year is called the part two, unlike in Cambridge where it's the part three. But unlike the Cambridge part three, it's a full year of research. So I did I finished my finals at the end of the third year, and you do all of your exams and then you get them over with, and then you move on and you do research full time. And it was interesting that part two course was introduced after the Second World War, when there was a sense that The UK didn't have a strong enough science base, particularly in chemistry, and it wasn't able to compete with Germany. And so they introduced that as a way of beefing up UK science and chemistry. And so, you know, sort of interested to reflect on where the challenges are and where we think our competition is now. Anyway, I did that, and I joined the lab of Professor Cheetham, Tony Cheetham, who some of you may have known or loosely have known. He came across actually to Cambridge, and he was an academic in Cambridge later on for many years. And I worked also with him and Chris Dobson. And so Chris Dobson was, of course, the same Chris Dobson who sadly died last year, who was the Master of St. John's. But at the time, he was a chemist at Oxford in the inorganic chemistry department, and he had a solid state NMR spectrometer. And so what I wanted to do in my PhD was to think about how to develop solid state NMR spectroscopy for solid materials. So NMR spectroscopy was in solution was very common at that time, but solid state NMR really hadn't been developed. And so the specific aims of what I did was to think about the NMR spectra of paramagnetic solids. So Chris Dobson had been working on NMR spectroscopy of paramagnetic liquids. And then he and my advisor, Tony Cheetham, put a project together, or they thought about putting a project together on paramagnetic materials. And the reasons for some of the other parts of my slides will become apparent. Now, I've got millions of slides, and James and Nick will be horrified if I show them all, but I just want to give you a couple of pictures just sort of to motivate some of the discussion. So I'm going to go through them very quickly. So I was really very lucky in this part two project. So that's again the same as the part three in Cambridge, with my two advisors, Tony Cheetham and Chris Dobson. Almost randomly, we found some oxides, some tin oxides, which we wanted to study for catalysts. But we looked at the effect of putting paramagnetic ions in them, and we discovered something really very interesting. And so the material I looked at was an yttrium tin oxide. And when I doped in this paramagnetic ion samarium, you could see these extra peaks that emerges. So this is the peak for the tin in this compound. So I'm doing tin NMR. And then this is an environment now where actually there's one samarium in the local coordination shell, there are two samariums on this one. And then you can also see the other full samarium oxide impurity. And so this little observation when I was a part two student actually led to a Nature paper, because it was one of the first examples where people had been able to take an NMR spectrum of not just the solid, but also doped with a paramagnetic ion, and actually come up with a rational explanation as to why you might get shifts in these compounds. And this then led to the whole of my DPhil research. So in Oxford, because it always wants to be different, you don't do PhDs, you do DPhil, so Doctors of Philosophy. And I continued on that work in Oxford again with Tony Cheetham, but also working with people in Warwick to really understand how the NMR spectra of paramagnetic materials might evolve and could be used. And we also showed that they could be useful to understand catalytic materials. And so I can sort of, I won't sort of bore you with all the details. But that was what I did for my doctorate. And I made links again with catalytic materials. And I also worked with someone called John Thomas. And again, he's somebody that's familiar to the Cambridge scene, because he was at the time at the Royal Institution in London, going backwards and forwards between Cambridge and the Royal Institution. And he was the one who introduced me to NMR spectroscopy of catalysis and catalysts. And so I worked closely with him for a while. And of course, he sadly also just died recently in Cambridge. It was a bit of a sad story at the moment. Anyway, so I'd done my DPhil, and I was in this solid state chemistry group, and I'd been working a little bit with Chris Dobson, but I really felt that I wasn't, I needed to do more physical chemistry, and that I needed to improve my NMR skills. And so when you finish your PhD and you want to stay in academia, it's typical to do a postdoc. And I thought what I really wanted to do was to find a postdoctoral position whether it would be hardcore physical chemistry, and I'd really learn about NMRs and I'd learn about Hamiltonians, and I would really focus on that and become much more serious. And so as a result, I moved to the Netherlands again, to Nijmegen, which is a town right at the east of the Netherlands, just next to the German border. And I learned or re-remembered some of my Dutch, though never got fluent again, but did some of the very earliest measurements on how to measure distances in solids. And I developed a measurement or way of determining the distances between carbon and nitrogen in a solid. So pretty esoteric. But the way it was done was a different approach for doing it. And so I did that for a year. And then I decided that actually I liked not just to do the very hardcore physical chemistry, I liked to combine it with materials. So I then decided to look at working with somebody who knew the theory of what I had just developed. He had a better understanding of it because of an experiment he was working on. He was also in a more applied area, and he was working at DuPont Central Research. So DuPont's a very large American chemical company, and they used to have one of the biggest research labs for chemists. So it's called Central Research and Development in Wilmington, Delaware. So I moved there to work with him. So with Lex Vega was the name of the person there. And there we came up and we rebranded my NMR spectroscopy experiment to be called Trapdoor NMR. And so NMR spectroscopists like naming their experiments with silly names, and the better the name recognition. So he convinced me that if I wanted my experiment to be used by other people, it had to have a good name. So Trapdoor stands for the transfer of adiabatic passages in double resonance NMR spectroscopy. So that's why it's called that. And it's a very simple experiment, and we applied it to other things. So this is an application where we're applying it to measuring proton aluminium experiments, and we put a pulse on the protons, and then we irradiate the aluminiums. And depending on how close they are together in space, that determines the dipolar coupling. You can use it to filter or to select for for environments where the protons are close to aluminium. And we in this case, we were using it to study a phosphine molecule on the surface bound to an aluminium Lewis acid site. And when you look at the difference experiments, you can tell that the phosphine is coordinated to the aluminium Lewis acid site. So I started to get very interested in catalysts. And this is another example where we're looking at a zeolite, ZSM5. So this is the sort of one of the major cracking zeolites, where you can look at the proton to aluminium distances as well. And you can see signals, even if you can't see them by NMR. So at that, I did my 2 years in industry. And at that time, I decided that as someone who does NMR, I didn't want to be in industry. And it was not per se that I wasn't interested in industry. It was more that I wanted to be able to define myself what I wanted to do. And I didn't want to sit in a lab and someone else come in and say, look, here's a sample, why don't you look at it? And at that time, I looked for academic positions. I looked for positions back in the UK and in the US. But the US at that time could give you a lot more kit to do what you wanted. And I really needed an NMR spectrometer. And so the best place I identified to start my academic career was at Stony Brook. And at that time, it was called the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And this is why I've got the picture. So Stony Brook is on Long Island, and Long Island is the island that John JFK, the airport, is located just across the water from New York City. And it's right on the so-called North Shore of Long Island, the South Shore, and out here is the Hamptons, where people like Alec Baldwin live, and that's where the sort of ritzy houses are. But the North Shore, the Great Gatsby didn't live there, but Scott Fitzgerald had him living here. And so Stony Brook was right at the end of the Gold Coast. Anyway, it was quite a beautiful place, but it also had a good chemistry department, and also had a very funny colleague who used to like redoing logos. So this was his logo specific for the chemistry department, and my more pedantic colleagues would actually say that this doesn't make sense as a distillation apparatus, but anyway, as a logo, it's not a bad one. And when I was at DuPont, I had got quite interested in environmental issues, and DuPont had been responsible for producing all the chlorofluorocarbons in the world, which was one of the major producers of chlorofluorocarbons, which had been responsible for creating an ozone layer, so a hole in the ozone layer, rather. And so as a result, because of that and the Montreal Protocol in 1990, there was a phase out of chlorofluorocarbons, and hydrofluorocarbons were introduced instead as a sort of temporary solution. And people like John Pyle in this department have been really responsible for actually doing the modelling to show that the ozone layer hole has disappeared. So it's been a sort of ongoing thing in environmental chemistry. But I got interested in how you made these new hydrofluorocarbons. And so I came to Stony Brook with research on hydrofluorocarbons, on catalysts. And just wanted to sort of interlude to say that it was a very beautiful place. And one of the things I like doing is photography. And so this is a view of a beach in the US and a sunset. And then, this is also in New York in the fall foliage. So it's a lovely place to live for 16 years. And this is just jumping now to the Montreal Protocol, which was the treaty that set out the reduction in chlorofluorocarbons. And so by the time I was coming in as an assistant professor in the US, they were having to be dropped completely. And so I got into the catalysis associated with the replacement of the chlorofluorocarbons, and it was this molecule 134A, so CF3CH2F. And it was made by very complicated routes with lots of different impurities. And so I was interested in not only the catalysis, but also the separations of it. And we developed, so I'm not only an NMR spectroscopist, I like to use lots of different tools to throw at the same problem and come at it from different ways. And I happened to be next door to Brookhaven National Lab, where they had a synchrotron source, so a bit like Diamond in the UK. And we developed some of the earliest methods for looking at how catalysts change during their operation, so in situ. And so we built this setup where you had a catalyst sample and you flow gas over it, and you could watch the transformation of the catalyst while it was in operation. And so in this case, you were seeing an alumina forming an aluminium fluoride. And of course, it was in America, so this was an alumina. And the aluminium, aluminium. And that was another thing that was quite interesting when I was in the US in teaching, was that if you teach, you have to speak the language of that's appropriate to where you are. So I had to learn that it was no longer methyls, it was methyls and carbonyls versus carbonyls, aluminium, aluminium. Anyway, that's another side story. So I did a lot of work on these chlorofluorocarbons and replacements. And then I also, at the same time, I met somebody from Duracell who asked if I could examine some of his battery materials he was starting to look at. So this was in 96. So the lithium ion battery had been invented in 1991 by Sony, and it was still very much in its infancy. And so all of the battery companies were trying to retool and decide whether they'd move from a primary battery, like a AA battery sold by Duracell or Energizer or Rayovac, into these rechargeable batteries. And so someone from Duracell came to me, asked me if I wanted to work with him. And we then went back and thought about how to do NMR spectra of these materials. And some of the materials that we were looking at in these compounds were these lithium manganese oxides. And lithium is an NMR nucleus, manganese is a paramagnetic ion. And when I first took the spectra of these things, I had no way of interpreting them and no way of making any connections between the lithium local structures and the oxidation state. And so that sort of spurned this whole little research project that I had on how do I extract information from an NMR shift. And that then spun this whole research area in my group, where we developed the whole systematic understanding of NMR shifts of paramagnetic materials, now with transition metal ions. And because I'd done this very esoteric research as a PhD student, I sort of had a good head start because I understood the theory and we applied it to develop this whole field. And that's really been a massive springboard for my research ever since. And without going into sort of details, we were able to use information to understand spectra. And more interestingly, we worked with colleagues at MIT to then develop a material that had extremely high rates of charging. So you could work at a 1C charge, which means a 1 hour charge, 4C charge means a 15 minute charge. And so we could get this material to charge in 50 minutes. And ironically, it was not considered to be a good material at this at the time. And so we shifted gears on it because of it wasn't good enough for car companies. And now in a meeting of Jaguar Land Rover last week, one of the people in the company just said, oh, we're really now looking at these materials at lithium NMC with 50% nickel and 50% manganese. I'm like, oh God, this was what we were working on 20 years ago. And you told us we weren't allowed to work on them. Anyway, life comes around in circles. So just quickly moving through that. The other thing I wanted to mention was I got very interested in using the same approaches to look at environmental issues again, this time looking at how iron oxides could be used to sequester pollutants. And one of the things that iron oxides can be used for is ways of sequestering anions, and the most toxic anion, in particularly in the Bangladesh Delta, are arsenic anions. And so we developed a whole research program about trying to understand how iron oxides could be optimized for looking at arsenic absorption. And I suppose the only point I'm trying to make is that what seems like maybe esoteric research can actually be applied in lots of different ways. And hopefully you can think about ways that sort of have impact beyond just the what could seem sort of quite narrow focus in the lab. And so this was some work we did on the iron oxides and the sorption. So I also had a research group at the time in New York with one postdoc who was an amazing cartoonist. So all of my acknowledgements, instead of having photos of people, would always have cartoons. And so this was someone's stuff in the glove box at the time. And this was an accident in the lab we'd had. And this was my NMR machine in the basement on a bad day. I had a postdoc who was pretentious, thought he was an artist. And I had another postdoc who came from university in New York, who was actually spent time with us, who was actually funded by the CIA, hence that portrait there. Anyway, so that was Stony Brook. And then I moved to Cambridge, and I moved there about 10 years ago. And this was the basement of the labs underneath some of the undergraduate practical labs, which had also been where all the radioactive chemistry had been done in the chemistry department before I came. And so for safety reasons and fairly obvious reasons, the whole place had to be gutted. And so this was the lab I was offered when I joined the department. And you can see it took quite a bit of imagination to convert into what it is now. But we got it ready, and it was all beautifully redone. And this was my intrepid team who had the guts to come from the US to Cambridge to join me, despite the state of the labs. And this Fiona Strobridge was my first Cambridge undergrad, and then did a PhD with me from Magdalen. And she is went to finishing her PhD. She moved on to back actually to the US, where her first job was in Apple, working on batteries. She's now working on in artificial intelligence and AI. And so this was when Yusuf Hamid, who is now the person who gave the large donation to the chemistry department and why we've changed our name, he gave some money to my lab to help renovate it. And so we opened that 10 years ago. And this is me trying to sort of explain to him what we do inside these glove boxes with batteries. And so that was literally 10 years ago on pretty much this year. And so this is my group when the lab was sort of opened up again 10 years ago. And so you can see we've got a bit better, and we've now got carpets on the lab. And here are our NMR spectrometers. This is our 700 megahertz spectrometer, which is the high field one. And we also have other ones not shown here to do our battery research. Anyway, with that, I'm going to end, but that was just the sort of the beginnings of me coming to the department and really trying to use and develop a research group around using NMR spectra to look at the next generation of batteries and fuel cells. And I've talked to some of you about this, and there are plenty of places on the web where you can hear me giving talks on it. So I think I'll end and take some questions.
Thank you very, very much for that. It's a big ask to get you for over 20 minutes to sort of explain in such a coherent manner an extraordinary career. And I think the point to make to our young colleagues is to reemphasize what Jeremy said, what James said at the beginning of this presentation. You are one of our most distinguished colleagues. And there is a point to my question, so bear with me for the next 5 seconds. You're a fellow of the Royal Society. You collaborate across the country and around the world. You've got the largest group in the building, a very prolific, productive and happy group. I guess the upshot of my question is, while people are thinking questions, so for all of you listening, there is an opportunity for you to ask questions. If you could do this through the chat facility on Zoom, we'll give everyone a couple of minutes so that Claire can answer a couple of quick questions, and I'll read out the questions so that Claire can respond. They can be about research, they can be about her career. But Claire, my point is, how do you manage your time? I mean, that's really quite extraordinary work you do. How do you do that?
I think, you know, I should be honest, like most of us, badly. It's not easy to manage one's time. I've always, from the beginning, when I was, so in the US, I was an assistant professor, and that's a very stressful period of one's life because you have 5 to 6 years to demonstrate that you're good enough and before they give you a permanent appointment. So in the US, the model is you get lots of money, or you get enough money anyhow, and then you've got to get research grants, you've got to do research, and then you've got to demonstrate that you can raise money and you can be productive. For some people, it can be quite stressful. I always try and protect 2 hours of my life in the morning to do things that I want to do, that somehow progress things that I feel are important. And so that by the time I get to 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm not the most early riser, so it really is 11 o'clock, I can, you know, hopefully smile at people and not feel too stressed about the things that haven't got done. So even if not much has been done, I feel at least 2 hours has been done. So that's my strategy.
And how do you relax? Do you actually ever relax? I mean, it's fine to manage your time, but do you find ways to relax?
Well, I was going to, you know, I knew you might ask me that. So I just thought I'd put one photo of how I like relaxing. So this is my favorite hobby, which sadly I'm really upset by, is cross-country skiing. So cross-country skiing, when I lived on Long Island, there was a lot of snow. And so that's where I used to relax, particularly in the US, back in the UK. I got my skis out in the snowstorm we had. I managed half an hour on the snow in Thetford Forest. Don't report that to Boris Johnson, because that's, you know, slightly outside the Boris rules. So that, and this particular picture is in Yosemite. So this is this beautiful valley in California. And this is Half Moon, the Half Dome there in the background. So I play the cello, you know, badly, but I still play it. I bike. I've been biking in lockdown. So I do quite a few other things. So.
Well, whatever you do remarkably, because we're all sort of in admiration, look at what you do and your productivity, and it makes us feel incredibly humble. Maybe it's just giving my insecurity. A couple of questions have come through. So one from Alex Harrow. What inspired you to work with batteries and fuel cells in particular?
So I've always been interested in trying to apply what I do to environmental issues. And so when I started in Stony Brook, it was the focus on catalysts and the chlorofluorocarbon, hydrofluorocarbon issue. But I have to admit, with the batteries, there was a degree of serendipity. I mean, I mentioned this man I met from Duracell, who had introduced me to the problems he was having. And then I also used to play squash with my colleagues from this national lab, who there was some really nice squash courts in Stony Brook opposite my office. So there was no excuse not to get down. And so they were electrochemists. And so the combination of meeting this Duracell researcher and then playing squash with electrochemists really got me into the area. And so that then allowed me to send a student to Brookhaven Lab to learn how to do this. So it was a complete transition for me. I was a solid state chemist. I mean, I think I can call myself an electrochemist after so many years, but my training had been solid state chemistry. But it was the fact that, and then I was positioned to have something to apply to the field, because I knew how to do the NMR of these types of materials. And I was probably the only person at the time with that training. So I was just very lucky. And then the fuel cells came, because when I started as an assistant professor, I was interested in how ions move through solids. And so I was able to see that that was an important problem of optimizing a fuel cell. So it was that sort of combination of the fundamental science, but saying, you know, how could that be relevant? And I think it's an interesting debate people have, is what's the role of blue sky science, where you think about things and you do things that in some ways could seem esoteric, whether you do applied or more focused research. And, you know, I think both are important, because for me, ironically, my PhD or DPhil was very much blue skies. There was no real application for what I was doing, but then I could then use it 10, 15 years later and actually do something useful with it and sort of join it up together. So that's how I got involved. Serendipity, like most things in life, but sort of recognizing where opportunities are. And also just, I just like doing things that I can see some relevance to, and that's what drives me personally.
Okay, and Gareth is obviously very well informed. Offers his congratulations on the Nyborg funding.
Oh, thank you.
And he asked if you could talk about that, where it will go in the future and how you currently contribute to it.
So that's another nice example. It was spun out of a PhD project of one of my former students, Kent Griffiths, who had materials that could be used for very fast charging of anodes. And, you know, this is a chemistry audience, so one has to be now totally honest. You've got an anode, now you've got to pair it up with a cathode. But I touched very briefly on that cathode material that we had developed 20 years ago. So we're putting them together. We have, again, this is sort of semi-confidential stuff. We've put a little team together in Cambridge. We have we've got a lab near the new train station, which when we can travel will be useful. And we were very lucky that we, at the same time, a battery company had been bought by a Chinese company who had gutted it. And as a result, there were some employees who were unemployed. So we've hired them. So we have a little production team, and we're trying to get prototypes. Because so when you form a company, you have an idea, but then in the battery space, the next thing you need to do is to demonstrate to your customers that your technology works. So you've got to put together the demonstrations to do that. So we're working on that. We're working on applications in small applications. So, you know, traditional areas where battery companies start are in power tools. I know it doesn't seem like the sort of most exciting place to go, but you need to sort of demonstrate it in a way where it's small and it's not going to have so many safety consequences. We're also looking at medical devices and other ones that you will make a press announcement hopefully soon over. But at the same time, we're doing a demonstration. We're trying to put demonstration projects together with electric vehicle type applications. But our technology is quite expensive. So sadly, I don't think it's going to be used for massive rollout in cheap electric vehicles. So we're trying to also, sorry to go on about this, but maybe it's interesting, go to put the whole fast charging electronics behind the battery to make it a bigger company. And whether we do that will dictate whether it's a small materials company or a bigger company. And time will tell. We'll have to see. You know, these things are a challenge.
It's an interesting space, both for research and for technology.
Yes, and we've got some really cool people in the company. We've got somebody who's worked with Tesla. We've got somebody who's worked for DuPont. And so let's see. I mean, it's the tech. You know, it's the equivalent of the dot-com Wild West at the moment. And like the Wild West, you know, many people meet sad ends and other people survive. And let's hope that we survive in some form or other, not with not too many scars. And in answer to your question of how am I still involved, I'm still nominally the chief scientist. And I mean, I am the chief scientist. So I do meet with the team once a week to review the science questions. And so you make a battery, you've got to put it all together. You've got to choose what the electrolyte is, what the cathode is. And so there are a lot of science questions that need input with. And we've got another battery scientist as well, who's quite senior, was more senior than me. I know this might be surprising in age, who's helping us too. So.
OK, Hey, Alice asks a practical question, especially now with the various lockdown limitations on placement and work experience. I mean, as a young scientist who wants to go in academia, she asks for some advice about how one prepares for academia when you can't do things like placements and get research experience as an undergraduate. What sort of advice would you offer to someone at this stage in their career?
Well, I mean, the Faraday Institution, which is the UK's battery initiative, runs summer projects called FUSE projects, and they will run them this year. And they're online. It's not ideal, but where possible, and, you know, our august leader is on this call, Professor Keeler, Dr. Keeler. So it's very much a moving space as to how much will be allowed in the lab, but everything will be in principle online. And I still think that's a good opportunity because I think you get to see what a research group looks like. You get paired up with a PhD or a postdoc and attend group meetings and you learn something about the science and either you are able to make a measurement yourself or you can... Or someone can make a measurement for you that you can interpret. I think the sort of hardcore synthesis activities are harder, but the sort of work we do, I think that an online experience is worth it. I think there are still it's really tough. I mean, I do feel for you that those hands-on experiences will be harder, but I think even if you were to do these online things. And then transition, then maybe you then do a similar part three project next year where there's at least some commonality. And that at least allows you to talk to PhD students and postdocs and get a sense of what's going on. And it's not as if the academic community is insensitive to the challenges that you face in terms of navigating it. And I think one of the things that's very difficult when you think about what research you're going to do next is, I mean, I remember when I was trying to choose my research project, you have no idea what you're going to like because you've never done it. And you've got some sense as to whether you like synthesis based on an undergraduate lab, but the experience is very different. And the sense of the sort of pressures that you work on under in undergraduate labs are very different from pressures in a research lab, because there you've got to get in done in time and you've got to get the right yield and you're sort of judged if you don't get 85% yield or you don't know what the blue stuff in the bottom of the flask is. While as in research, you know, that's the challenge, is to figure out what the junk in the bottom of the flask is and why things have gone wrong. And so it's a very different experience. And so somehow, I mean, I think that the message also is that most of us do find a way, even if you get it wrong first time round, to steer into the direction where they're happiest with. So happy to discuss more about, you know, the routes forward offline. You know, those sort of conversations I'm always very happy to have with people.
And that's something I think will also offer opportunities, possibly after the end of term and the beginning of next term, for some of the undergraduates to meet some of the PhDs and postdocs as well to get some advice. I mean, I know James, being James, cares so much about being able to bring our students in to do research. And I don't think there are any promises. It depends what happens at university and government level. But I think his view is, and he sort of sends a note that, you know, if we're able to, we will be able to host a limited number of summer students in the lab. But he's been pushing this agenda very, very hard, both from the perspective of the students getting the benefit and also the labs getting young people to work in the labs as well.
Yeah, and just so that you understand what the challenges are from people like my lab. I mean, my lab works in shifts, 4-hour shifts, because of just the sheer density of people and access to the equipment. And so it's just very hard to accommodate more people. But I think we will have to think more creatively about limited experiences or times to go in to at least get some hands-on experience. So I really think things are going to open up a bit. I'm optimistic that by the time we get to the summer, it's going to, you know, just be much easier. Yeah, they're not normal, but easier.
And that'll be communicated as much as well as we can. I think we've got time for two quick questions, if that's okay with you, Claire, because again, we don't want to just take up a whole Zoom hour. So two quick questions. One's from Yutong, and again, it's a sort of a bright young scientist is asking a question about coping with change in a sort of dynamic career. I think most undergraduates find it very difficult when you're an undergraduate to think about your career changing in such dramatic ways and in such high impact ways as your own. What advice can you give to people about coping with change?
Well, I mean, I would say, I think that's something that your generation will, it's going to be normal. That idea, when I started, there was still the possibility that people would go into a chemical lab and that would be where you'd be for the rest of your life. And that has changed. That my generation, that is not possible for us. So it will be one of change. I mean, I've always liked change in the sense that it allows you to do different things and to look at things from different angles. I mean, I'm not in any way downplaying the difficulty of change, because for me to return from the US to the UK, you know, there were a lot of difficulties. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I mean, you get used to where you are and the best way of doing things, and then you go to a different place and, you know, the frustrations are different and the good things are different. And so it takes a while. I mean, I just think that all one can do is to sort of look at and think about change as being a positive thing and it revitalizing thing and not to see it as a negative. And I think one of the things that's nice now about even the startup space is that if you get a job in a startup company and your startup company fails, you're viewed as somebody who's a better and more employable person that was in a successful startup, because you've actually had to understand and you understand more about the differences and the challenges associated with that. So I say it's tough. I'm not going to deny it. I think we all would like to imagine that we have a career and a trajectory that we can define. But I think in some ways there's also some positives about change. So,
okay. And the final question from Tristan is a more technical question. Your thoughts about organic redox flow batteries, and do you think they'll replace lithium ion batteries in the medium to longer term?
Oh, I think, I can see Edward Chellert is on this call as well, who is a summer student in my lab. I think redox flow batteries are the future for grid. We have, I mean, I can speak volumes on this subject. We could be here till 3 p.m. The lithium ion battery is close to its fundamental limit. There's only so much you can get out of a material because it's this heavy. You know, you go above 4.8 volts and the oxygen wants to bubble off. And so if you want a big battery for grid storage, you've got to decouple the idea of an electrochemical cell with where you store. And so redox flow and fuel cells, in my opinion, will start to look merge towards something. And I don't know what that battery is going to look like, but by 2050, we had better come up with a cheaper redox flow battery that's going to allow us to make more impact of storage on the grid. So absolutely, I think redox flow is a really exciting area to be in. And there are some companies that are pushing down the price, and there's arguments that that if you can scale up the manufacturing of redox flow, it should come down in price in the same way that lithium ions have. Lithium ion batteries have come down yesterday or on Friday beyond $100 per kilowatt hour, which is the sort of unit of price. You basically put a price against the energy, and so for the first time they've come down to that. So that's where redox flow has to come to for it to be competitive, and has to be much, much cheaper, much more sustainable. You can't use cobalt, you can't use nickel. And so anyway, again, this is happy to spout on redox flow for a long time.
Well, some hints for people who want to go in this career in the future.
Yeah, but it's also a really cool chemistry. I mean, we've done some nice stuff where we flow our molecules from redox flow batteries through NMR machines, through ESR machines, through UV-Vis, and we do online spectroscopy to watch what's going on. And so from the fundamental science, it's a really wide open space as well.
Look, this is absolutely fantastic. Claire, it's been a real privilege. Thank you for making the time. We know you're incredibly busy. It's wonderful to have someone like you talking to our undergraduates so that it gives them some sense of the interesting backgrounds. And I mean, listening to what you said about your career coming from sort of relatively interesting international background to Oxford and Cambridge. Oddly enough, our boss, James Keeler, came from a very working class background, Oxford, Cambridge. Chris Dobson, Oxford, Cambridge. Cambridge. So it seems that you all peak at this great institution. So I don't know what it means for our undergraduates already here. They have to go on to something even greater.
Even better.
Indeed. So look, thank you very much. Some of the notes that have come through have all started with expressing their gratitude for a fantastic talk. Really is wonderful to see it in such an informal context as well. And hopefully people were encouraged to bring along their lunch or have a cup of tea while listening. Absolutely fantastic. And I think what we'll do is we've got your okay to, we've recorded this so that those who couldn't join us today can hear the presentation at some point in the next couple of weeks. But we're really, really grateful to you. It's wonderful work. Good luck. And I'm sure that people now that have been in touch with you, you may get some emails from some people with inquiries.
But before we end, can I just thank you all for coming, and hang in there let's try and make an effort to do some form of undergraduate research or some sort of undergraduate, whatever form and shape, even if it is online, is valuable. And hang in there and life will open up more. And I think there's a lot of exciting stuff to be done in the energy space, and I think it's a really nice area because it spans a gamut of areas where there's really good fundamental chemistry that needs to be done. I started life as a solid state chemist, but now we're doing redox flow, which is organic chemistry, and I transitioned through physical chemistry. So there's the whole, and I didn't talk about the work we do on theoretical chemistry and DFT calculations and MD, but I think for me personally, energy has the similar challenge as healthcare did 20 years ago. And so it's just really, I think you lot are the lucky ones because you can go off and, really make change. And so go for it.
Well, Claire, thank you very, very much. Thanks, everyone. Hopefully we'll arrange some more of these sessions next term when you come back and you're prepping for exams. And again, we really miss the opportunity seeing you in person, but that's something has been conscious about, and the teaching committee have been working quite hard to make sure that we can offer as productive a term under the most difficult of circumstances. But I think all of us, the advice we'd offer is to be resilient, to stay confident, use the people around you who can support you and help you, and we'll do everything that we can. But as it's the end of term, have a great vacation, and we'll catch up with you again next term. Thanks, everyone. Have a nice day.
Bye.